A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on March 25, 2001, in the series A Fresh Look at an Ancient Story, entitled Why Jesus? The texts for the sermon are 2 Corinthians 4, verses 1 through 6, and John 1, verses 1 through 5 and 14 through 18. Copyright, Grand Valley State University.
My exposure to people of other faiths is minimal. In my own experience, the relationships with the Jewish community have been the most meaningful, and I have been enriched by that association with the West Shore Committee for Jewish Christian Dialogue. I found Rabbi Elpert in Muskegon a princely man. Rabbi David Hartman from Jerusalem, who's been with us several times, so intoxicated with God, so full of the Spirit. The most recent guest, Rabbi Yitz Greenberg, again, a gentle scholar, devout, and so genuine. I've known fewer Muslim folk, but they're too far from the TV image of the Islamic terrorist. I've found sincerity and a deep hunger for God. I've never really known Buddhist, but in our world today, you can't help but be exposed to that in the media, or one sort or another, or through reading. There too, a wonderful transformation of the human being through that path, that dying self and that living in another consciousness. Those experiences with people of other faiths have been enriching to me in recent years, whereas once they would have been very threatening to me. I was already ready for them, I suppose, through the recognition of that universality of God's grace, and I was beginning to see how God revealed God's self and God offered grace, not only through my own religious tradition, but through other traditions as well, that they were authentic ways and experiences of God. It was in 1990, I think, that I sat in the magnificent cathedral in Chartres outside of Paris. And there was an Englishman who'd lived there for many, many years who gave lectures. Malcolm Miller was his name. A fabulous lecturer on that cathedral. He knew every nook and every cranny, every stone. And he pointed out something that I hadn't been aware of before, that the cathedral in the old ancient time was like the community library. People didn't read, people didn't have the printed page. But those stained glass windows told stories. And they became the teaching by which, the means of teaching by which people were moved into the biblical story. And you could go through the cathedral and you could follow from creation to consummation the biblical story in stained glass. And as I sat there, I came to realize that which I've shared with you here before, but I do it again. I came to realize a parable. For the stained glass windows were diverse in the stories they told. But I thought to myself, you know, if you only saw one set of windows, If, like some of you, you came to church every Sunday and picked the same pew, it's not a good idea because the pastor always knows whether you're there or not, of course. But if you did, you'd only see one set of windows and know only part of the story. And then I thought to myself, maybe this cathedral is a parable of the respective religious traditions. What if the Christians were gathered in the nave and they saw the light streaming through these windows, and the Muslims were in the transept and they looked at another set of windows, and the Jewish people in the choir looking through that magnificent rose window, and the Buddhist off in the other transept, and so forth. You get the picture. And it struck me that which made all of the windows luminous with teaching and meaning was a common source of light. Such a simple idea. But for me, it was a parable. And it became a means by which I could move easily into that pluralism in which I live and move and have my being. That pluralism that recognizes that in the great religious traditions of the world, the one eternal God is manifesting light and conveying grace. And so, that being the case, at least for me, which for me, incidentally, was so liberating, so freeing, I met a lot of other people for whom that's a very threatening idea. That if my truth is not the only truth, then somehow or other my truth is diminished. I don't understand that. For me, it was the most liberating idea because I could look at the other, the one who is different from me, and not see there an alien. Not see there one who was a candidate for conversion or worse, a child of hell. I could see a fellow pilgrim. Someone whose own pilgrimage could enrich mine through the nuances of that spirituality, and I as well might be able to be a means of grace to another. So for me, that was a liberating idea. But if that is indeed the case, and I do believe it is, then the question this morning is, why Jesus? Why all the fuss about Jesus? Why do I want Jesus to walk with me? Why in this Lenten season do we rehearse again the stories of the Passion moving toward Holy Week? Why Jesus? Why in our prayers and our hymns and our liturgies, why is there such a concentration on Jesus? Why Jesus? Well, let me suggest why Jesus this morning. The Apostle Paul, in his letter to the Corinthians, that second letter, makes a beautiful, concise statement, where he says, we preach not ourselves, but Jesus Christ as Lord, and ourselves as your servants for Jesus' sake. For the God who said, let light shine out of darkness. In other words, the Creator God, or God, that God, has shined in our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Christ. Why Jesus? Because God is revealed there, we believe. We have seen, as I like to say, in the face of Jesus, we have seen into the heart of God. Jesus is the embodiment of God. What we see there is reflective of the nature of God. We believe. And so why Jesus? Because that mystery that is God must somehow or other come into sharp focus for us, must come into some tangibility. And Paul says, that to look into the face of Jesus is to get a clue as to the heart of God. But John, I think, even more profoundly, in the first chapter of his gospel, says much the same thing. But, you know, Paul was the first to write in the 50s, 20 years or so after Jesus. But John, now near the end of the century, the gospel of John, this more philosophical, more thoughtful portrait of Jesus, because Jesus didn't come, you know. The kingdom didn't come. The heavens weren't opened. Everything didn't come to consummation. The preaching of John the Baptist was not realized. That apocalyptic hope seemed to come to nothing. And so, if it didn't happen the way they were anticipating it would happen, what did it mean, after all, this Jesus encounter? And I love the way John's gospel has it. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And we beheld His glory, the glory is of the only Son of the Father. Oh, the law came through Moses, to be sure, but grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. There was, in other words, as Paul said, an unveiling, a revealing. But even more, there was that embodiment. There was that flesh. The mystery took on human form and dimension. And John says, that which was in the beginning, before our eyes, took human shape. I like the translation of that first verse. In the beginning was the divine intention. The Greek word can bear that meaning. In the beginning was the divine intention. And that divine intention eventually eventuated in a human being. So that the profound revelation of God is seen in a human. I don't believe that John, obviously, the writer of that gospel, didn't understand our cosmology. He was operating with his own cosmology, obviously. But what he said translates so beautifully into what we know about our universe. 15 billion years, Big Bang, cooling of the elements, the planetary system, the emergence of life, eventually conscious life, self-conscious human being. And then 2,000 years ago, a human being, and they said, that's it. There it is. That's a clue to what God is. That's an indication of what we are called to be. John's testimony was that the divine intention from the beginning, whether for John that was 4,000 years prior or what, whether for John there was a three-decker universe with heaven above and hell below, it doesn't matter. His cosmology is incidental. What he was saying is that in the beginning there was an intention. an intention that unraveled, that unfolded a dramatic cosmic story that eventuated in the human and in a human, Jesus. And John said that was the realization, the manifestation, the human statement of the divine intention. The scientists in our day love to discuss and argue about whether or not the universe was made for humankind. There are those who describe the anthropic principle, which says that all of the fine balances, all of the things that have happened over this 15 billion years, eventuated in just the right setting, environment, possibility for life and for human life. And there are others say, oh, come on, willy-nilly just an accident. Well, you can choose your, you can make your choice. Pay your money and make your choice. Doesn't matter really, because here we are. And we're looking to Jesus as the highest and the best, the realization of the intention of God. But I like to think of that divine intention being pervaded throughout by that serendipitous creativity of the Creator God, so that all of the emerging, evolving, biological, historical development, all of that is the consequence of the lure of love. That spirit that knows no coercion, but only persuasion, that beckons this process on to the point at which there was a human being. And in the midst of humanity, there was a certain Jesus. And they said, by God, that's it. That understanding of Jesus is different than the understanding of Jesus with which I began my life and my ministry. Jesus for me, Jesus in the tradition, was that one who was with God in the life of the Trinity, who as the second person of the Trinity came from outside in, assumed our human nature, died for our sin, bore our sin, was resurrected and left again. That divine intruder, if you will, that one who came as the gift of God to be the sin bearer of the world in order that there may be forgiveness and reconciliation. That's not how I understand Jesus, obviously, in what I've been saying to you this morning. I understand Jesus not as one who has come from the outside, from another realm. I understand that Jesus as one who emerged in the process through the Creator Spirit, who became the enfleshment of the divine intention, and whose life is the clue to God's purpose and meaning for human life as a whole. How do I make that shift? Because certainly that old conception comes from the New Testament. There's no question about that. How do I make that shift from an outsider divine coming in, bearing our sin, and moving out again? I make it by understanding that Jesus, in the historical context in which he lived, this is where all of the historical Jesus research is so fruitful. because it shows us a concrete human being in his historical, social, political, economic context. It shows us a human being who responded to his context. One who looked at the society of his day and saw the exploitation of imperial Rome and the collaboration of his own leadership of his people. Saw the destitution, saw the hurt and the pain, the poverty, the despair, the powerlessness and the voicelessness of the multitudes. He looked at them and he saw them like a sheep without a shepherd, harassed and tossed about. And Jesus was able to communicate to them somehow or other their dignity as the children of God, to remind them of the covenant of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. Jesus was enabled somehow or other to call forth their humanity once again. And Jesus also saw the power structures, the power brokers of his day. He also saw how the people were being used and abused, the leaders of the people forgetting that they were the servants of the people, becoming instead the masters of the people, exploiting the people, using the people. And he spoke truth to power. He went to the very center of the nation. He went to the very temple in Jerusalem. And there he brought his word, his good news about another kingdom, an alternative way of being. And they killed him violently. And there, in that life, in that one, I see the realization of God's intention. A couple of weeks ago, I raised the question, what's wrong with us? What's wrong with us? We live by animal instincts, that old survival instinct that we took with us from the jungle. What's wrong with us? And I asked last week, do we need God to be good? Can't we see it? Can't we understand it? Can't we see how we destroy ourselves, destroy our planet, destroy society? Can't we see? Can't we see it? We're responsible. We have knowledge. We have a relative freedom. Can't we see it? Do we need God as some threat beyond us, some lawgiver from beyond? Can't we see it? Don't we see it in our own lives and in our society in our day? What's wrong with us? What's wrong with us? So we are not like Jesus. And what I see in Jesus is the only hope for the transformation of the world. Am I a dreamer? Of course I'm a dreamer. What do I see in Jesus? I see peaceful non-resistance. I see righteousness incarnate. I see the truth spoken with integrity. I see self-sacrifice. I see a willingness to stand in one's truth, even at the cost of death. I see one, and here I believe he is the incarnation of God. I see one who meets evil with forgiveness and with grace. I see one who meets hatred with love. Love your enemies, he said. I see one who gives us an impossible ethic in the Sermon on the Mount, concluding in Luke's version with, be ye therefore compassionate as your Father in heaven was compassionate. I see Jesus. Why Jesus? Because Jesus is the way and the truth and the life. No one will come to the experience of communion in the Father's bosom without that Spirit of Jesus, that grace of Jesus, that truth of Jesus, that integrity of Jesus, that fearlessness of Jesus, that freedom of Jesus, that magnificence of Jesus. It was April 15, 1984, Palm Sunday, in this place. The title of the sermon was, Jesus, You Are Really Somebody. And I had come through all of my own torturous way to see Jesus in all of his humanity. Rather than that second person of the Trinity, that divine Savior, that one who came, true God, true man, with two natures, all of that Christological structure, rather than that, I began to see Jesus in all of his humanity, and I was so impressed, and it struck me that I really had seen a Dietrich Bonhoeffer, for example, as far more impressive than Jesus. Dietrich Bonhoeffer moved me. The story of his martyrdom moved me. Why didn't Jesus move me? Because Jesus was from the outside. Jesus lacked that full humanity. And then when I began to see Jesus and his humanity, I had to say, Jesus, you are really somebody. Then I had to begin to translate all of the symbolism, because all of our prayers and liturgical forms and our hymns and our anthems, they're full of Jesus in that other conceptuality. So I have to translate now. I have to read it. I have to see it, understand it as poetry. But when I survey the wondrous cross on which the Prince of Glory died, I see there a place of violence, of one who died in order to give expression to the divine intention from all eternity. And I want Jesus to walk with me. And when I see that cross and contemplate that life, and I know that such love, such strength, such grandeur of person, reflective of the heart of the eternal, demands my soul, my life, my all. It's the only hope we have. Lord, I want to be like Jesus.